From post-psych blues through pastoral folk and jazzy interludes to pushing the boundaries of rock as we know it, Jethro Tull have remained constantly musically progressive without being prog. After all, when it comes to describing the music of one of the greatest bands in the world, categorization becomes superfluous. He writes the music, sings the songs, he is a consummate live performer, and he wields a heavy metal instrument. He is Jethro Tull founder and frontman Ian Anderson, and he joins me on the line from London. Welcome to Rock of Ages, Ian.
Thank you very much indeed. I could almost have written that myself.
Straight off the bat, and most importantly for myself, certainly, and for all the other fans out there, you're coming back to South Africa in November for a string of live performances. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a short string. It's, I think, four shows, and we squeezed it in fact, between two US tours, so it's a bit of a frantic period of time, really, and my daughter's expecting a baby in a few weeks' time, so I'm trying to spend some time at home with the new addition. So I'm so there's a bit of a fleeting visit for me. I fly in the morning, play a show that night, and then do another three shows, and then fly back home again, try and grab a few days before I head back to the USA. So it's a bit like it's a bit like what I do most of the time. It's always a bit frantic, you know. Sometimes it'd be nice just to have a whole week at home instead of just two or three days between tours. But who's complaining? At least I'm still in work, and no one's given me the gold watch yet.
It's your second tour in South Africa, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's about 15 years ago. I think.
Yeah, I saw you when you came out here.
So, yes, it'll be interesting to see how it's changed, and I'm sure it has, because South Africa, a little bit like where I'm headed tomorrow, off to Israel, you know, is one of those countries that has quite a big history, you know, quite a global kind of level of history, in the sense we've all been paying attention to what's been going on, and it hasn't been easy, clearly.
Yeah.
Probably won't be in the future either, but that's part of what takes me to those sort of places, that without getting involved in the politics, it is nice at least to kind of be there and hear what people say and hear it firsthand instead of just watching it on CNN.
Yeah, it's coming up for nearly four decades. It's amazing to think that the band have been around for almost as long as rock, per se. What's motivating you to continue touring and writing and recording new material and making relevant music?
Well, when I say that it's my job, I say that with a great pride, because when I was a teenager, I was listening not to rock and roll or pop music or the Beatles or whatever it was. I was listening to folk blues and jazz and stuff that was, you know, certainly not the material of pop music. And the thing that marked out this music for me as a teenager was that you know, my musical heroes were not 3 or 4 or 5 years older than me. They were older than my dad, most of them. So, and some of them were even dead by then. So, you know, my whole kind of growing up with music was the idea that it was stuff that got played by people who were, you know, in the 40s or 50s or 60s, and I rather like the idea that music was a career choice rather than just some flirtation with a bit of stardom and being famous for a day, and my ambition always was, and happily it's worked out for me so far, that, you know, music was a job for life, and it's one that obviously is whimsical and romantic, and you travel around the world and you meet lots of people and stay in nice hotels and play in lots of interesting places, but at the same time, it's a job in the sense that it's an obligation, and once you've said you're going to be somewhere, you can't phone in sick after a late night the night before and say, you know, hey, I don't think I'm going to be coming into work this morning. You know, you have to show up, and that's that makes it, I think, a kind of a job that has both responsibilities and ethical responsibilities.
Listening over the years to the music, one thing has always struck me about the band is the wide range of influences that make up the often complex melange called Jethro Tull. Not only rock and jazz and folk and blues, which are the obvious, but elements of medieval music, madrigals, gypsy reels, Celtic, and I suppose these days is somewhat disparagingly called world music. How does this melting pot come to life for you as a writer, and how does that writing process unfold for you?
I think the music that I've always played has been infused with elements of what these days are called world music. It's been since 1969 onwards my little knack of picking up elements of Asian and Arab and Eastern European and Irish and classical music and bringing these little subtle flavors into the music. And I never thought and don't think now that I would be successful as a, you know, as an Irish folk musician or as a classical musician or as a blues musician, because I'm, you know, culturally and ethnically not of that sort. So, you know, I have to do really what we in the UK are. We're a mongrel race made up of hodgepodge of people from all over, you know, most of Northern Europe, and these days, of course, from the Caribbean and Asia as well. So we are well infused with an enormous amount of influence culturally these days in the UK, and I suppose it's natural that my music takes on that form, since I'm born of that age of, you know, when particularly during the 50s and 60s, you know, there's a huge immigrant population arrived in the UK from Bangladesh, from Pakistan, from India, from the West Indies. And these days, of course, a huge number of Eastern European folks coming into the UK to work and in many cases to settle. So all of this, I think, is probably reflected in my era of music making. And I feel like a chef in the kitchen, really, just playing around with exotic herbs and spices and cooking up a bit of a stew that is somewhat exotic and trying to make sure that the flavors hang together in a palatable way, rather than being destructive forces that don't join together. And I think, in that sense, I do feel like a bit of a musical chef. But it's dirty work, but somebody's got to do it.
Other than yourself, the longest-standing member of the band is the highly underrated Martin Barr. Having watched so many live concerts and DVDs of Jethro Tull and seen the wonderful interplay between the two of you, do you still surprise each other musically?
I think we surprise each other whenever we walk out on stage every night, really, because I'm not sure what we'll be playing when we come to South Africa, but right at the moment we actually start the show, just the two of us go out and play a kind of a country blues piece together, just guitar and voice and harmonica. It's a kind of a low-key start to the show that is, you know, just a change from coming on with all the bells and whistles and fanfare. So, you know, in a sense, when we walk out on the stage every night at the moment, it is that feeling of, two people who've been sort of a musical partnership for a long, long time. And it is kind of surprising in some ways, but maybe what's most surprising is that there is a tendency to take each other for granted. And I think it's only when, in some ways, when you do things without the others, then you do kind of evaluate rather better what they do in fact mean. So when you make a solo album, we go off and do a solo tour, as I frequently do, and Martin goes off and does other things on his own. I think when we get back together again, we come together with a renewed sense of purpose and mutual appreciation.
The country blues track you're referring to, that would be "Someday My Sun Will Shine For You," wouldn't it?
"Someday the Sun Won't Shine For You," yeah. Which, of course, Martin did not play on the
original recording. Of course, Mick Abrams, yeah.
Because that was in the months preceding Martin joining the band, which he did at the end of 1968.
It's funny, I played that track 2 weeks ago on the show. Looking back on the various periods of the band, the varied lineups, the sometimes thematic albums, etc., do you have a favourite Jethro Tull period? I mean,
well, I would have to say, in all honesty, in more recent years, I feel like, you know, my musical horizons have been expanded and my flute playing has become much more, both broadened and probably better in terms of just having applied myself a bit more seriously in the last 10, 12 years to playing the instrument. It's one of those things I did for 30 years and then suddenly thought, I think I should try and do it better. So I really kind of buckled down to trying to plug some of the holes in my playing and see if I could try and be an improver. It's sometimes hard to do if you've played an instrument for a long, long time, but I did definitely make some major strides forward playing the flute during the last few years, and that has made it much more enjoyable to me to be on stage feeling, you know, that I definitely do something that other folks don't or even can't do. And I play with a lot of professional flute players in orchestras and so on, and, you know, not to in any way denigrate their efforts or their abilities, because they can all do stuff I can't do. But I do know that I do have this ability in an overall musical sense and a technical sense as a flute player. There's stuff that I do that they'll never learn to do in a month of Sundays, and vice versa, which is the good thing. You know, we all have our skills and talents, and we all can teach each other something. So I think that's probably been, you know, for me, the best time has been the last few years. In terms of recordings, I mean, there are certain landmark records like Stand Up in 1969, the Aqualung album in 1971, Songs from the Wood in 1976, Crest of a Nave in 86, Roots to Brown Shoes in 96. You know, certain records that for me jump out as being kind of landmarks along the way. They're good benchmarks for me when it comes to considering what I've done in the past and what I have to do in the future to equal or surpass some previous effort, you know, in my own, by my own standards and in my own terms. So, yeah, there's lots of landmarks along the way, but I don't think I'd swap what I do now for what I was doing 20 years ago, for example.
I mean, like most fans, I mean, I have my favourite Jethro Tull album, which happens to be Benefit, because it kind of represents a period in my life. But do you have one album that kind of you kind of pinpoint and say, you know what, that I'm really 100% happy with what we did there?
Well, I think probably the one that probably means most to me in a slightly romantic and nostalgic sense is probably the Stand Up album, because that was my first creative effort, you know, in terms of songwriting. It was our second album, and the one where I spread my wings a little bit and started to adopt some of the stylings and influences that at that point, you know, at age 22, that I was, nursing, I suppose, waiting for it to come of age. And so, yeah, that's probably an album I feel quite proud of that has a few tracks on it that are songs that we still play on stage from time to time today. So it's been quite a good album for me. I think one that I feel was an early sort of feeling of pride in something that I'd done. Interesting that the name Stand Up was recently used by an American guy whose name escapes me, but it was, I can believe my eyes when I saw an advertisement. Oh, the Dave Matthews Band, that was it, last year, came out with an album called Stand Up, and I read a review of it somewhere, and by the time my mind had untwisted itself, I thought, this poor chap is completely unaware of an album, and his record company, a major record company. You would have thought someone who said, Dave, actually, I think that title was used before, you know, and it's not like it was an obscure album. I mean, it did sell, you know, way more than a million records.
Absolutely.
It's quite funny, you know, when people do, inevitably, as happens, there's a bit of not intentional plagiarism, but just accidental copycat stuff with song titles and album titles and album covers and things. It does happen along the way. So, God bless Dave Matthews, but, you know, next time I think he needs to think a little bit harder. Perhaps next time around he'll be a little more inventive with his album titles and something.
In the live concerts that I've seen you a number of times over the past few years, what I've noticed is that a lot of younger fans coming to see the band now. What do you think that attraction is for them?
I think a lot of people who are in their teens and twenties, in a way, are trying to get back to understanding what their parents are about, really. And so they are, out of interest, going to maybe watch the movies their parents watch, read the books that they read, listen to the music their parents listen to. I mean, after several years of fighting with your parents, which is normal in sort of childhood and teenage years, comes a point you think, yeah, well, I wonder what old mum and dad were really about. You know, what was it that moved them when they were our age? And so I think part of it is a fascination, is a bit of kind of reuniting in a way with the culture of your parents' generation and your parents' taste, perhaps in particular. But it's also a bit like, you know, if you go to the British Museum in London, standing outside at 10 o'clock in the morning, you'll find queues of people waiting to go in, a lot of whom are people of, you know, various ethnic origins and on vacation in London and, you know, perhaps teenagers, people in their early 20s, going to look at really old things. And I think that's part of the attraction that you know, again, the Rolling Stones are out on tour at the moment. You know, they'll have a lot of young people in the audience going to see them in a way that it's a little bit macabre, especially when you think of Keith Richards, who looks like he's just been exhumed. There is that sense of going to see people before they die.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit kind of dark and a little strange. But I think there's a genuine curiosity, and I think a mark of respect in, amongst young people going to see older musicians in their twilight years, perhaps. But while they're still able to go out and do what they do, then good thing to go and see them, and you may not get another chance. During what was actually my birthday last week, and on my birthday I was visiting a friend who was hosting a party for the Stones in Montreux in Switzerland, and I bumped into Keith Richard, and we were just chatting when we came to say goodbye. You know, I had this terrible feeling, you know, a real kind of sad, sinking feeling in the pit of the stomach, that as I shook his hand and, you know, we kind of looked at each other, and they're not big pals or anything, probably only briefly just said hello to each other a couple of times in 40 years. And I just said goodbye to him and thought, you know, I won't see this guy again, you know.
Could it not also be because young people come and see the shows, also because there's nobody quite like the Tull musically? I mean, the bands out there and the music is being made now, even in what they call prog rock these days. I mean, there's nobody like the Tull.
Well, you know, you can say that. I don't want to blow my own trumpet about it, but obviously what I think that we do, and other people tend not to do, is that we do push the boundaries of what is generally called rock music in a way that is, in some ways, quite remarkably uncommercial. And yet we've managed to continue to play concerts all over the world and release records and carry on at a sort of level of activity and with a level of success that seems quite at odds with how distinctly uncommercial our music really is, because we've never been a band that you know, have hits or appeal to a kind of poppy crowd. We're not trendy, we're not fashionable, never have been. And so in a way, it's almost bucking the system. We're part of the music industry, we're part of the world of pop and rock music, but at the same time, we're out there on the edge, we're out on the rim somewhere. You know, we're part of it, but we're not part of it. And I rather like that sort of ambiguity that comes with being a rock band but not a rock band, a folk group but not really a folk group, and also being the flute player in rock music and having kind of no one really, I suppose, in direct comparison, internationally speaking, with what I do, then, you know, you do have a feeling of being a little special, even if not everybody's cup of tea.
I mean, speaking of recording, Ian, earlier this year we obviously saw the release of the acoustic Jethro Tull. Any plans for a new record?
We recorded about 8 tracks in February of this year in preparation for a new album, but we've really been on the road, you know, relentlessly since then. And my odd days back at home are usually spent in the office working on administrative things rather than being in the studio. But I've written a few more songs since, so we'll be back in January next year to do the second half of the recording, and hopefully we'll have a record out somewhere around May or June of 2008. But in the meantime, you know, we're playing a couple of songs from the next Jethro Tull album during our concerts, and it's kind of a bit of a tradition, really, in a way, to do that kind of little preemptive thing of playing a song or two from a new record before it's released, and people kind of, you can judge in a way very well by live performance whether or not it's something worthwhile or not. And I remember when we recorded the Aqualung album, we already had a couple of those songs under our belt from live performance, so we were pretty confident that at least 2 songs out of the 11 songs on the Aqualung album were going to be winners.
When you look back over your career, you must feel very happy as a musician and as a composer. How do you see Jethro Tull's legacy now?
one way to describe it, but I think what the big driving force that anybody in the creative arts has is that of frustration and the feeling that you haven't actually nailed it, you know, that you've, in a way that you've constantly probably fall a little bit short of your own ambitions, but that's a good thing. You know, if all you ever did was feel that everything you did was perfect and wonderful and couldn't be done better, I think you'd be either seriously deluding yourself or be a smug and rather irritating person. And most of my ambition is formed by essentially the frustration of not quite having done something as well as I think I could, and the idea of going out and trying that kind of thing again, maybe in a different way and approaching it from a different angle. That's part of the creative process. That's what keeps me going as a musician, is actually not a sense of how clever I think I'd be, you know, how much I've enjoyed it. It's actually more of a frustration. It's something that drives you continuously to see if you can't do better. Just as performing on live on stage is exactly that. You know, you think every night you come off stage, you mull over some of the things that went wrong during the show, and you think, tomorrow night, I'm going to crack that one. I'm going to do that better tomorrow. And you go out and have another go and fail again. But that's half the fun of it. You know, no, it's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be difficult.
What can the South African fans expect of the show material-wise? Are you going to be covering a fair sort of rainbow of the band's music?
We always try and play a few songs that are the mainstream things. Pieces like Aqualung and Locomotive Breath that are always in the show, and then there's a few other songs. Maybe an excerpt from Thick as a Brick or Bourree or Living in the Past or something we you know that we quite often play in our concerts. And we have a series of songs that are occasionally drawn from, you know, perhaps less obvious pieces that slip in and out of the show from year to year. And then we always try and play a few things that we know folks won't have heard before, because they've you know, they're recent additions to the show, either new songs or maybe songs written by somebody else, you know, because I do a few pieces that are classical in origin. So there's always the opportunity to create a few surprises, and for us also to be playing some stuff that's not part of the mainstream of our repertoire, so that we don't just feel we're a jukebox on legs or a musical hooker, which is, you know, if all you do is go on stage to pursue some mad idea of pleasing an audience, guessing, second-guessing what you think they want to hear, then I don't think ultimately that's a very honest or very satisfying thing to do. And I'm unashamedly selfish about playing music. I'm there for me to have a good time. You know, I'm there to get my jollies on stage. If the audience enjoy it as well, that's great. But the main reason is for me to be out there, you know, pushing the limits of what I can do, and on my own terms, trying to have a good show every night, doing what I want to do. I mean, in bed, I'm a generous fella. But when I go on stage, I can afford to be a little more selfish in seeking my own pleasures.
We've been speaking with Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull. Don't forget, they are touring South Africa 7th of November, Grand West Casino, Cape Town. 9th of November, Lords and Legends in Amanzimtoti in KZN. And the 10th and 11th at Carnival City's Big Top up here in Joburg. It's going to be an absolute gas. I'm going to be there. I know you will too. Ian Anderson, what a pleasure.
Well, nice to talk to you too. Look forward to seeing you in a few weeks.